Morning.
We want to welcome high school students with us this morning. We have students from Wauwatosa East High School. Would they stand, please? Welcome. You may be seated. We have students from Horizon High School. Would they please stand? And a welcome from the court to you all. And we have students from the Pre-Law Society. Would they stand, please? And where does this Pre-Law Society sit? In what institution? Madison? Good. You are all welcome, too. You may be seated. The high school students are here with a national award-winning program cleverly entitled Court with Class. And with this program, we invite high school students across the state to come join us for a oral argument. And when they accept the invitation, they're sent materials about the case that they will hear. And when they come and listen to oral argument, a justice is assigned to speak with the group at lunchtime, right after this oral argument is concluded. The discussion is about the procedures of the court, not the substantive issues of the case that you are about to hear. And everyone is welcome to join with the justice and the students after this case concludes. If you would like a summary of the case, and you don't have one, if you raise your hand, we'll give you a summary. It's easier to understand the oral argument if you have the facts and the law set forth, or at least the issue of the law set forth. All right. Let me introduce the court to you all. Starting on my far right is Justice Annette Ziegler. Seated next to her, oops, she's not there. Flown the coop. She is not participating in this case. And I recite the justices by rote, not looking at the chairs. But I will now look at the chair. Justice Prosser, are you there? To my immediate right is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my immediate left is Justice Patrick Crooks, and to his left, Justice Patience Robinsack. And you will meet with this justice at noon, or thereabouts. And on the far left, Justice Michael Gableman. And that is the lineup for this case. So I will now call the case, and it's 06-AP-2933, Kara Horst versus Deere & Company. And arguing on behalf of Kara and Jonathan Horst is John C. Kavanis. Counsel, you may proceed.
May it please the court, I'm John Kavanis, and I'm privileged to represent Jonathan Horst before you today in this case. This case presents the issue of whether John Deere and manufacturers owe an independent 402A duty to bystanders. This court in Howells ruled that indeed there was an independent 402A duty to bystanders. In the Court of Appeals in this case, the court, after citing Howells, ruled that this court's decision in Green provides that as long as a product is reasonably safe to users and consumers, that that's the extent of a manufacturer's 402A responsibility. Now, that makes sense when you have a situation where a product is equally hazardous, dangerous to users, consumers, and bystanders. But I submit that that does not make sense where in a situation like here, And like in Howells, the risk to the bystander is unique. And here it is unique to the bystander. John Deere acknowledged and took the position in this case that the risk of reverse mowing presented a risk to children, predominantly under age 5, that was not understood and appreciated by its users and consumers. And it addressed that risk by providing extensive owner's manual information about the risk, by providing on-product warning labels that admonished and advised, never mow in reverse. There's no need to mow in reverse. They admonished and advised the users and consumers that they shouldn't have children in the work area. And that's because John Deere knew from its own studies that there was a pattern to accidents involving children, predominantly under age 5, where they were, in effect, attracted to riding lawnmowers and one run up to them, and often would be seriously injured. Now, the design fix for that problem is a no-mow-in-reverse feature. Since John Deere had concluded that there's no need to ever mow in reverse, the fix is pretty straightforward. Yet, on this particular riding lawnmower, John Deere included an override. They included an override purportedly for two reasons. Number one, to operate a snowblower attachment that wasn't available for this riding lawnmower. And number two, for the convenience of customers, so that when they wanted to go in reverse, that instead of having to stop and disengage the mower, the user could opt to press this override button and mow in reverse for as long as the user or consumer wanted. The patent for this system, for this override, indicated that it was included to facilitate mowing in reverse. Now juxtapose that with what John Deere's corporate position was, and that is there's never a need to mow in reverse. It's a misuse of this product to mow in reverse, as defined by John Deere. Yet what John Deere argues is that by providing appropriate instructions on the product and in the owner's manual to the users, that they've discharged all of their 402A responsibilities. By warning the user or consumer, they've discharged their responsibility to bystanders such as Jonathan Horse. I submit to this court that that runs afoul of and violates this court's holding in Schauber, where this court held that a manufacturer cannot delegate its 402A responsibilities.
Counselor, how would you define the typical bystander that a manufacturer should have in mind, and not just in regard to this product, because this case is going to go beyond John Deere's mowers or anybody's mowers. How would you define that bystander?
It would be as someone who is subject to potential risk within the proximity of the product. And let me add one other thing, Your Honor, because I think there's a little bit of confusion when you look at the cases. I look at three situations when it comes to product risk, and I'm going to throw children in there as well. You have products that have risk that's identical to the user, consumer, or bystander. And in those cases, the ordinary consumer user test works fine. There are also cases out there where you have children using adult products, using, not bystanding, but using. And then you have the bystander cases, which can involve an injury to adult as well as a child. It just so happens that in this case, the predominant person that gets injured is a child less than 5. There are adults that get injured in the data that's maintained by the Consumer Protection Agency. So those are the categories that I would throw out. Your Honor.
Why would you throw out a category of children of less than 5? Why is that a category? Isn't a bystander an objective bystander?
It is.
And you don't look at the individual characteristics. You don't look at whether or not they're smart or whether they have a mental illness or whether or not they're developmentally disabled. It's an objective standard, so why carve out something for kids?
I wasn't arguing for that. Perhaps I misspoke,
no,
Your Honor. What I was pointing out, I agree that the test should be as to the objective bystander, not a 5-year-old. I'm not arguing for that. But what I was pointing out, that when it comes to this back over risk with respect to mowers, that it's predominantly children who are injured. And that certainly, I think, is a factor under Sumnick that can be considered. But clearly, and I want to make clear, I'm not advocating for the ordinary child bystander test. So I agree with you in that respect.
Counsel, indeed we were to assume for a minute that there is a bystander contemplation test and that it's objective, how does that relate to this fact situation so that you end up getting a new trial? In other words, if it's an objective test, how can it relate to your 2-year-old client? Because wouldn't most objective bystanders, if you will, reasonable bystanders, recognize that there's danger if there's a riding mower backing up, coming toward them?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. And in fact, Deere recognized and acknowledged that the user doesn't understand this risk. And in fact, that's why Deere so thoroughly warned its users in the owner's manuals and the on-product warning labels. If it was open and obvious, as you posit, there would have been no need for Deere to include any warnings. And the risk is not the blades whirling in and of itself. Everybody understands and appreciates that. And I'm not arguing otherwise. However, here, the risk is this unique risk in backing up, when in fact, it's Deere's corporate position that it's never necessary to mow in reverse with this mower. And I submit to you, Your Honor, that applying the objective bystander test, in this case, to answer your question, is that the ordinary bystander wouldn't contemplate that a riding lawnmower would have its blades engaged in mowing when there was no need to do so. That would be beyond the contemplation of the bystander. And the user only has that knowledge because of what's in the owner's manuals and what's in the on-product warning label, which here, the bystander does not have the benefit of. The bystander does not have the benefit of those warnings and that information. And in fact, what Deere is arguing is that we should get out of jail free card as long as we adequately advise the user operator about what we know about this unique risk. And that violates Schauber. I think in this case, because the judge didn't ask the verdict question as was approved, discussed, and housed, and because the jury was not instructed and we weren't permitted to argue the ordinary bystander perspective, that we were left with the facts that we essentially had conceded pre-trial that this product, in terms of the user and consumer, was not unreasonably dangerous because they had adequately warned. So I think given the facts of this case, there's a reasonable possibility that upon retrial, we can prevail on the strict liability claim.
Is that the test, reasonable possibility?
I'm familiar with your dissent in Green, so Justice Crooks, I would say that I understand the issue. I know that there's been some back and forth in the cases. As I read Green, in the majority opinion, I believe the test is reasonable possibility. But I, in this case,
my opinion, I believe, was a concurrence, trying to point out that it should be probable.
Okay. I'm sorry, I referred to it as a dissent, but I am familiar with your concurrence that the test should be reasonable probability. And I understand in particular your concern about the fact that this test applies in criminal cases as well as civil, which you pointed out. But I think in this case, in Green, as you may recall, the issue was whether there should be a new trial because of some admission of expert testimony that really was cumulative. And we're dealing with a different situation here. We're dealing with jury instructions and a special verdict which weren't submitted so that the jury could never consider our arguments on strict liability with respect to this product. And I think that's, you know, a much different situation than Green, just from a factual standpoint. And again, plaintiff's lawyer didn't decide that people shouldn't mow in reverse. John Deere did. Plaintiff's lawyer didn't decide that this mower should have a no mow in reverse feature. John Deere did. John Deere then is the one that decided that they would put an override button on there. And in the evidence in this case, it's clear that people like the mow in reverse. And even though that's, from Deere's perspective, not necessary, because the industry allows people to mow in reverse, Deere didn't want to take the hit in sales by not providing their customers what they want. And I understand that. I'm not saying that's an unreasonable corporate decision. And in fact, I concede and can agree that it's probably why the jury determined no negligence here, because Deere was no worse than everybody else in the industry. On the other hand, we were barred from presenting our strict liability claim. And the whole function of strict liability, the whole public policy, is for situations like this, where a manufacturer makes the decision, not saying it's wrong, but to sell a product that's knowingly dangerous or unreasonably dangerous in a respect, knowing there are going to be some injuries, calculating and determining the cost versus sales. And I think one of the public policies is that in those situations where a jury determines that the product is unreasonably dangerous, that it's fair that the company pay for the cost of those injuries rather than we the taxpayers or we the insurance payers.
Let me, if I might, ask you one more question. My understanding is that when the circuit court judge instructed the jury, that she added a sentence referring to bystanders. Were you then in a position, and did you, I'm assuming you were the trial attorney.
I was.
did you then argue to the jury that they should focus on the bystander aspects of this case and focus on the fact that the child was a bystander?
I did my best, but I was handicapped because what the sentence said was something along the lines that the obligation to provide a reasonably safe product extends to bystanders, but it has to be unreasonably dangerous to the contemplation of the user or consumer. And that was the special verdict question. So what I was barred from doing, Your Honor, is getting up and arguing, just like I have to this court, that in terms of the defect question, that they had a duty to, even where the product was reasonably safest to the user or consumer, that it wasn't as to the bystander, because the bystander didn't have the benefit of the warnings, didn't have the benefit of the owner's manual, didn't know that this hazard exists in the way it does. So it was handicapped in that respect, Your Honor. And I believe that it is harmful error, and it did deprive Jonathan Horst of a fair opportunity to prevail on his strict liability claim in this case.
Counsel, let's take a look then at the special verdict. Let's get specific as to what your concerns are. I'm looking at the appendix 139 that has the special verdict, and of course it is question number one that is the area of your concern. Question one, as submitted to the jury, says, do you find from the evidence that the subject lawn tractor, when it left the hands of the defendant, Deere & Company, was in a defective condition so as to be unreasonably dangerous to a prospective user or consumer? That, you get the question? That is, do you find that when it left the hands of the defendant, was it in a defective condition so as to be unreasonably dangerous to a prospective user or consumer? As stated, what do you think the correct answer to that question is?
No. And I conceded that in summary judgment motions before the trial.
Now you wanted to add or bystander.
Correct.
And then you would want the answer to be yes.
Correct.
Explain to me why it makes any difference in your mind and the authority for your assertions, that is citations, why it makes any difference.
The reason it makes a difference in this case is because the risk to the bystander is unique. And that was recognized in Howells, where this court determined that manufacturers do have an independent 402A responsibility to bystanders. It also, in this case, comes into play with Schauver, because Schauver says a manufacturer can't delegate its 402A responsibilities. And here, we conceded, and I think it's correct, that the riding lawnmower with the warnings on it, with the information in the warning owner's manual, was reasonably safe from the perspective of the user or consumer. Now, if we end there, Deere gets a free pass in terms of the bystander, the next door neighbor, the kid that runs up behind this tractor, who doesn't have the benefit of the warnings, doesn't have the information, or the adult as well. And that bystander has no reason to believe or to expect that a riding lawnmower is going to have its blades moving, cutting, when it's not necessary for it to do so. And here, John Deere had determined in its policy that when a lawnmower is backing, there's no need for it to be mowing. So it's the perspective that makes a difference.
Okay, the perspective makes a difference, but what's your legal authority that you should be adding bystander? I know you want to, otherwise you think you're going to lose. What's the legal authority for it?
Well, in Howells, first of all, the court passed on this very special verdict question. And 2nd 268, there by its facts, in Howells, it was the bystander that was at risk. And in Howells, the court passed on the jury instruction used by the trial court, which was as follows. Was the John Deere mower in question, when it left the possession of the manufacturer, Deere and Company, defective in design so as to be unreasonably dangerous to a bystander? That was the special verdict form in a bystander case that was passed upon by this court in the House case. And that's why...
Your language carefully when you say it was passed upon, because in House 2, that's exactly the question that was there, set forth in the opinion. But I'm not sure that the... maybe passed upon is exactly the right words, because it didn't discuss it at length. It didn't say it was bad. It just said this is the special verdict question that was submitted.
Correct. And in the context of the facts of that case, where clearly on the facts, the risk was unique to bystanders. And it wasn't a risk that presented itself to the user who was on the riding lawnmower. So I think it's the combination of, and my passing, or the court passing on the language in combination with the facts of the case, which is in that category that I talked about earlier, where the risk is unique to the bystander. It's not the same risk that the user was exposed to. And in fact, they're different. So the question for this court is, do manufacturers get a free pass on bystander cases as distinguished from those cases that involve risk to users, consumers, and bystanders that is an identical risk? And that's why we submit that in this case, it was error for the court not to so ask the jury and not to instruct them from that perspective.
If that's your perspective, that it was the wrong question asked, that you agree with the jury, you're telling me the answer no if you just have a prospective user or consumer, because it wasn't your argument, it wasn't unreasonably dangerous to them because they knew what was going on. Amicus filed a brief saying, hey, if the right question wasn't asked that complies with how, then the real controversy was not tried here. But you didn't make that argument.
I didn't argue for the adoption of a risk utility test, if that's why.
No, I'm saying under, what is it, 75106, and sometimes these numbers fly in my mind, but I think it is 75106, that case should be reversed in the interest of justice. And what is defined as interest of justice? That the real controversy is not tried. That's the argument that's laid out in the Wisconsin Association for Justice. You didn't make that argument. Why not? You think they're right in their argument?
Obviously we argued that the case should be reversed and remanded for trial. And, you know, our argument is principally on the fundamental error in the jury instruction and the special verdict. And I think it's synonymous with the justice amicus. I think it is the same argument. And obviously, I'm in agreement with that.
Well, suppose we agree with you. You still might not win because not every jury instruction means reversal. Why do you think it was so prejudicial here? I mean, that's what you have to show, that it's prejudicial, and whether you do possibility or probability, the real test is, does the error undermine your confidence in the jury verdict? Isn't that the real test in whatever you use otherwise?
Because when you look at the facts of this case, it's unique. Unique in that you have a manufacturer who recognizes people shouldn't mow in reverse. That's their corporate position. They adopt a safety feature, which is no mow in reverse. And then inexplicably, they provide an override for that safety feature. And by virtue of the failure to properly instruct on the duty to bystanders and to ask regarding the duty to bystander in the special verdict question, I was deprived of the opportunity to meaningfully argue the strict liability when you have a situation where the whole industry essentially is allowing people to mow in reverse, even though the position is that it's dangerous and shouldn't be permitted. So I think when you just look at the 402A claim here, it is the strong claim. And on the facts, it's strong. Deere admitted each element. So I think using the reasonable probability test on the overwhelming evidence regarding this hazard, this design fix, and Deere electing to allow the bypass of this important safety feature, I think there is a reasonable probability on remand we can win the 402A case. Thank you.
Thank you, Council. Mr. Zaleski, representing Deere and Company.
May it please the Court. My name is Michael Zaleski of the law firm of Quarles & Brady, and I, along with Lars Wilbranson from Quarles & Brady and Nancy Rappaport from the DLA Piper firm, represent the respondent, Deere & Company, in this matter. Before we begin, I'd like to make a quick personal observation. 45 years ago this coming May, I made my first oral argument. It was part of the UW first-year law student curriculum, legal writing. Today is my last oral argument because after today, I am officially retired with Quarles & Brady. I mention this not because of any envy or sympathy or whatever, but because of an irony. The judge in that first oral argument was an attorney named Shirley Abramson. And today, my very last oral argument, she's presiding over, along with the rest of the justices, my final oral argument.
I've outlasted you, Counsel. I'm outlasting you.
And maybe for 10 more years.
20. Counsel, you may proceed.
One other common factor. I had sweaty palms in that first oral argument, and I have sweaty palms today. One thing I've learned in the 45 years is that oral arguments, you prepare an oral argument, which I've done. I've got it right here. Then there's the one you give. Then there's the one you think about laying awake in bed at night. We all know that. I'm going to skip from the one I prepared in light of the questions and counsel, Cabinet's comments, arguments, to something different than the one I give. I want to attack head-on this nonsense about defective product and the get-out-of-jail-free card or the free pass the Council Cabinet is saying Deere is trying to utilize. But to do this, I have to backstep a moment and look at the history of strict liability. This Court adopted several decades ago, in the Schaubel case, the concept of strict liability, Section 402A of the Restatement of Torts. The reason for the Restatement of Torts and the concept of strict liability is because people who were harmed many times were being denied access to the courts because they couldn't get over the privity issue that they had to face when they sued under warranty cases. So the restatement and the people on the restatement committee wrote 402A, and this Court adopted it, as many others have. What is the difference between that and negligence? The difference is the focus is on the product. It is strict liability about the products. You don't look at the intent or the conduct of the manufacturer, Deere and Company, in this case. So if you were to call it a somewhat limiting remedy in certain respects, it might be, or it might be an expansive remedy. It depends, I suppose, how you look at it. Is the glass half full? Is it half empty? I would say it's probably more expansive for litigants to be able to pursue strict liability. But with that expansion of the tort law comes a responsibility, and it's you have to show this defective product. Now, how do you show this defective product? You look at it from what this Court has stated, the consumer contemplation test. What would the consumer or ordinary consumer or user contemplate? And counsel keeps saying, well, I want an ordinary bystander test. Okay? And the appellant is not an ordinary bystander. He's saying it should be an ordinary bystander test, but he doesn't finish the doctrine of 402A. Because if you go back and plug in the words ordinary bystander, every place that ordinary consumer or user appears in the jury instruction, which tracks 402A, it becomes nonsensical. It's gobbledygook. It doesn't make any sense. For example,
which instruction are you reading, Mrs. Zaleski? 3260, 3262, 3268, which one?
3260.
Okay.
And counsel, okay. Now, because of the doctrine, you are to look at, when you look at strict liability, the concept of the product, as I said. And it states that, and I'm paraphrasing, isn't dangerous to an extent beyond that which would be contemplated by the ordinary consumer and counsel says it should be bystander. And he stops there. Then the instruction goes on to say, who purchased it? So in this case, I don't know what you put in, but then it's with the ordinary knowledge common to the community as to the product's characteristics. That is key. Again, the emphasis on the product. How do you show a contemplation of an ordinary bystander with ordinary knowledge common to the community as to the product's characteristics?
I want to focus on that language because I think that language is so important.
I do too.
Good. Let's take a look at it.
All right.
That language, of course, comes from comment I of 402A, which we adopted in Vincer, that Esther Williams swimming pool case. Okay, I'm reading actually from comment I. And it says, the article sold, and it's essentially the same as in our instruction, maybe a word missing here or there, but the article sold must be dangerous to an extent beyond that which would be contemplated. Oh, buzzword, must be talking about some test here. Contemplated by the ordinary consumer who purchases it. Ergo, consumer contemplation test. But let's say this ordinary consumer is named David. Okay? David is this ordinary consumer. So what does I tell me about what does David need to know? What does David need to know? He's the ordinary consumer. And so the rest of the sentence tells me what David needs to know. The consumer who purchases it, that's David. Let's say someone out here is named David. And that, the way you define David is this, with the ordinary knowledge common to the community as to its characteristics.
Correct.
It doesn't say with the ordinary knowledge common to consumers in the community, does it?
No.
It doesn't say ordinary knowledge common to users in the community or bystanders in the community. It says the way you define the consumer is someone, anyone, with the ordinary knowledge common to the community as to its characteristics.
Right.
Okay. So I often thought, since I have nothing better to think about, why is it the consumer contemplation test? Why isn't the user contemplation test? Because when 402A came into effect and when we adopted it, it was consumer slash user. You know, well, why consumer? Why not user? And I think this is it, that it doesn't make any difference whether it's consumer. Well, what doesn't make any difference whether it's user or, you've got to watch me, it doesn't make any difference if it's a bystander. Why? Because they're defined in 402A and then our cases adapting it as someone with ordinary knowledge common to the community as to its characteristics. Ordinary, of course, means reasonably objective person with knowledge common to the community as to the product's characteristics. So when I look at this language and how you define this mythical David, that's how you define it. Someone with ordinary knowledge, reasonably objective knowledge common to the community as to its characteristics. Doesn't say it has to be a consumer, doesn't say it has to be a bystander, doesn't have to say it's a user. No response, because I'm just dying to hear it.
All right. First of all, you're really going to hack up this jury instruction if you accept this, because you're going to have to delete who purchased it to begin with, because the bystander doesn't purchase it.
Who cares who purchased it? You started your argument with, why do we have 402A? Let's look at the history. And you know what your argument was. Your very first comment was, get rid of privity. That's why we have 402A. Get rid of privity. So who cares who purchased it if we're getting rid of these concepts of privity? The carryovers in the history of the implied warranties where you needed privity that predate 402A.
Because apparently then I'm not making my point listening to your comment. because strict liability, we're not talking privity, I'm not arguing privity, strict liability focuses on the product. A bystander can't, they could, but it's unlikely that they contemplate. And also, in this record, what was in the trial court? What was introduced about the standard? Who the ordinary bystander is, and what evidence is there of what the ordinary knowledge common to the community as to the product's characteristics is? There was no evidence of it.
Okay, now you go to sufficiency of evidence, but that's okay. Not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about the words of 402A and the principles behind 402A,
and
the essential one, getting rid of
the focus on the product.
Right.
And the person who best focuses on the product is the consumer or user, because I'm going to decide when I go out to buy a lawnmower, I'm going to look at my yard, I'm going to look at my mowing tendencies and what have you, and decide what best suits my needs.
Yeah, but Mr. Zaleski, I've got a kid, I've got two dogs, I've got a cat. I want to buy something that is not dangerous to any of them. I'm a consumer and I'm a user. But I don't have blindfolds on just for me. I'm interested in my neighbors too.
That's correct.
Is it gonna throw grass or dirt on my neighbors? Is clumps gonna hit my neighbors? I'm interested in the whole thing, the whole product. Maybe lawnmower is a good example. Snowblower is a good example. I'm interested in who's standing around and I'm gonna hit. When I lose,
and you have a remedy. You have a remedy in negligence.
Ah, but the remedy under the case law is also to bystanders. We added that, even though it wasn't under 402A, right?
Right.
Okay, so there you got it, and that's old law. Old law is good law.
But the bystander can recover under negligence. But it was, the jury rejected it in this case. They were instructed on it because of how safe this equipment was.
Well, that's the issue in the case as to whether the instructions were correct. And then, if they're not correct, the issue is, was it prejudicial error? So, you know, and you make the argument that you have to put in bystander in every sentence that you use user or consumer. I don't think that's true. I think there are times when you have to do it, but not other times.
This court, after Vincer and Green v. Smith and Nephew, suggested to the jury instruction committee that it revise this jury instruction, and it did. And it never once said anything about ordinary bystanders, or whatever. The bottom line simply is that, again, it's not like we're denying access to the courts with someone who's harmed. Mr. Horst, or young Horst, had a remedy available under the law of negligence. The jury was properly instructed on negligence. They found Deere was not negligent. Mr. Horst, the appellant, doesn't contest that. All of the negligence was placed on the parents. My goodness, you couldn't have more warnings. They specifically warned in the operator's manual and on the machine about this very accident, to the point they showed a picture of a child being run over with a leg severed, saying, don't mow in reverse, keep kids out of the area. And yet Mr. and Mrs. Horst violated every single warning given to them, which they knew and understood, causing this tragedy. But, you know, I'm going to point out something else that's just maybe a little tangential, maybe not. The counsel is seeking to expand tort coverage here with strict liability, expand the scope of strict liability. Deere's not looking for a get-out-of-jail-free card. We are merely asking this court to enforce strict liability as it's written and as this court has interpreted in the past. But even if it is more restrictive, if one might argue, that's not unusual. You've done that before. Take the economic loss doctrine.
Yeah, take it.
Yeah. Please. But take it. You said in all courts have said of the economic loss doctrine, of course,
Some of us like it.
Yeah. What's happened with it? That was the case in which the economic loss doctrine, this court said, and most courts around the country have said, if not all of them, that we know tort applies. But, you know, back off. There's too much tort law. So we're instead going to limit your remedy to the cause of action available, the remedy available to you, namely breach of warranty. Even though it may work some hardships, after all, there's a different statute of limitations. There's the privity concept. but you restricted it because there was a remedy. We're saying in this case, there was a remedy, negligence. Deere passed it unanimously with flying colors, if I can spit it out. And in strict liability, you concentrate on the consumer and the user and the product, because they are the ones who are in the best position to know what is needed and what the ordinary knowledge is for their needs and uses. That's what strict liability is.
But 402A makes the definition of consumer so broad that it can be, in comment L, it says consumer includes not only those who in fact consume the product, but then it goes into a laundry list of others, including members of the family of the purchaser, or his employee, or a guest at his table, or a mere donee from the purchaser. I mean, in making that definition of consumer so broad, the argument that, oh yeah, the consumer has a contemplation is diminished. What do you think about that?
I think that the notes to the restatement talk about bystander.
That's L.
I think so. I think, I'm not sure which one, but I think they said something to the fact they weren't going to deal with that. But then why did this court use such pervasive language in Green versus Smith and Nephew?
That's because we were fighting about restatement second and restatement third.
But you said in all strict liability cases. You didn't say in consumer user strict liability cases. You said in all strict liability cases, again, the focus being on the product, in that case, the latex gloves. That's the issue. And besides, I want to just quickly point out, too, on the Hollis case that counsel cited, the jury instruction was never approved by the court. They just cited what the jury instruction was. The issue at Hollis, too, was whether or not it was improper for the trial court to fail to instruct on both strict liability and negligence.
It wasn't, and I asked him that, it wasn't approved by the court. It was set forth in the Howes 2 opinion. But then we have later opinions. I look at that Giese opinion in 1983, and in speaking about Howes, does not set forth the jury instruction, but it's quite clear. It says that in Giese, the record contains evidence that the lawnmower was in a defective condition, unreasonably dangerous to users and bystanders. That was a Montgomery Ward lawnmower. You have other cases where in strict liability, you have jury instructions that say unreasonably dangerous to bystanders. I'm citing the Friedrichs case in
took place 29 jurisdictions, jury instructions in the one brief. Not one of them talks about that.
I looked at those. I didn't look at all 29 jury instructions, but I read your brief. But I said to myself, hey, if I were injured in Mississippi and I was looking at Wisconsin's jury instruction, you would be including that in the list because it parrots 402A. But I'm not sure that it really answers the question as to, let's say, the question before us. Question number one, special verdict. Was that correctly stating Wisconsin law? That is, that the evidence that the subject lawn tractor, when it left the hands of Deere and Company, was in a defective condition so as to be unreasonably dangerous to a prospective user or consumer. Isn't Wisconsin law based on Howes
1? Howes did not.
Howes 1 did. Howes 1 said that it can be unreasonably dangerous to bystander.
Well, we agree that.
That's right.
Bystander.
So why isn't the word bystander there, since that's what Howes 1 said?
I don't believe, yes, Howes said that, and the judge instructed the jury that young Horst could recover. She mentioned bystander in the jury instruction.
Yeah, but the standard is unreasonably dangerous to whom?
It is to the consumer or user.
But in House 1, we said unreasonably dangerous to bystanders included. We added bystanders.
I don't know if we said it exactly. Maybe you're right. Maybe I don't think we said it exactly like that in House 1. But the focus is on the product and the consumer and the user. Let's just look at something for a quick second here. The plaintiffs concede that this child is not an ordinary bystander. 20 months old, running around a blind corner where his parents don't supervise him, while his father is watching his other child who is in the yard, contrary to all the warnings given to the father on the machine and in the operator's manual. Now, if there's an ordinary bystander, stop and think about this. We all agree on one thing. What is the danger here? What is the hazard? It's children, probably under the age of 5, being back over and having a blade contact. That's what we're talking about, because my legs aren't going to fit under that power deck. Little kids' legs, tragically, and arms fit under them. Well, if it's the ordinary bystander, they're not affected by the risk. There's no risk to them. That's why it doesn't make sense to read it that way. There is no risk to an ordinary bystander if the ordinary bystander is everybody above the age 5. Because it doesn't present a risk. That's why you have to look under strict liability at the product. One thing quickly I want to mention, too, let's look at the facts. We keep talking about what counsel did about Deere and what happened in this case, and perhaps he's almost talking breach of duty, but that's a negligence concept, and the jury found for us in that regard. Let's look at this reverse implement option for a second. Prior to it being implemented, Deere learned about 3 to 4 of these tragic accidents a year. Since 1999, for the time of trial, when this RIO system was introduced, 1. That is 1 every 105 million hours of mowing. You can't make every product foolproof, especially when you have people who, as nice as they are, and how, no matter how aggrieved they are by this tragedy, they fouled up in spades. They did everything wrong. And we're talking 1 accident every 105 million hours of mowing grass a year, and Deere is a bad guy or something, is being inferred? I don't think so. Again, well, let's switch quickly to the no error.
Mr. Zaleski, I've been trying to follow Justice Bradley's questions to you. If you added the word bystander to the special verdict, do you see that really changing anything?
No, I see it not changing a thing, because if you look at this, and again, back to what Justice Crooks mentioned, I think the Anderson versus Holmes versus American Family, the most recent case, since your concurring opinion in Green v. Smith and Nephi specifically said there had to be a probability, not a mere possibility, of a different result. There's no possibility of a different result. Plaintiffs and experts themselves admitted that the device they were championing, this no mow in reverse, can wear down equipment faster. It doesn't prevent all accidents. One of the experts had in his file at trial a recent newspaper clipping when a little boy was killed by a riding lawn tractor with a no mow in reverse. They had no evidence that it was safer than the RIO system. They admitted the RIO system prevented accidents. They admitted all of these things. And one of the best things of all, one of the experts went out and bought a John Deere lawn tractor. After talking and opining about how bad these things are, he went out and bought one, equipped with this system. I mean, there is no chance that this is going to be any different. You know, Justice Prosser, you raise a good point, because it's rare that you have a case in which there are no disputes as to the facts. It's really interesting how this case went down. There was no dispute as to the facts. There was a dispute as to judgment as to what's a better system or not, but I can't think of a single dispute that there was. This jury, for the entire length of the trial, heard one thing: the design of this product with the RIO system versus the no-mow and reverse system, which even the plaintiff's experts admitted The manufacturers seem to be getting away from that. They're now making them without that. And many of them who have these systems have session overrides. Contrary to what Mr. Cabanis said, with the DEER system, it was purposely designed so that every time you wanted to reposition that lawn tractor, you had to go through this sequence of events, including pressing this button. As soon as you stop, put it in forward, if you wanted to put it in reverse to maneuver it again, you had to do it again. Most of them on the market, these lawn tractors, have what's called a session override. Once you bypass that system or override that system, you can go forward, back, whatever you want to do, sideways, until you shut the engine off with the key. We didn't do this. We said, consumer, here are all these warnings. Here are terrible pictures. Here's everything. Don't do these things. We know you're going to have to maneuver it at times, but don't do it. And we made them hopefully think every single time they wanted to reposition that lawn tractor.
Since there's no disagreement on the facts, as you've indicated, I'd like to try to stay focused on the law. And although the facts are interesting, and that special verdict question, following up Justice Prosser's question, which is on page 139 of the appendix, I think that the law in Wisconsin is that that language unreasonably dangerous to a prospective user or consumer in the appropriate case likely should read or bystander. So I want you to tell me where I'm wrong on this, because I think that the law is or unreasonably dangerous to a, includes to a bystander. And I think that's the law because I think House 1 adopted that without specifically having that language, says, you know, there's no difference between injured user or consumer and the injured bystander, and says that DIPL and the concept of strict liability applies the same to bystanders as it does. And then you have the jury instruction in House 2 that says unreasonably dangerous to a bystander. And then you have the Geezy case shortly after that that says unreasonably dangerous to a bystander. You have the federal court, what's the case? Tom something or another, that says unreasonably, Comanican. Thus a product not reasonably dangerous to the ordinary user or consumer might well be unreasonably dangerous to the ordinary bystander. You have one other case that I point to here, the Friedrichs case, that had a jury instruction, and the jury instruction said, although it wasn't the focus of the dispute, but unreasonably dangerous to a prospective user or bystander. I think that's the law. Tell me where I'm
wrong. Because with all due respect, I think you're somewhat mixing two different concepts here. We don't dispute the fact that a bystander can recover. What, though, is the standard? It's not the standard if the product is unreasonably dangerous to an ordinary bystander. It's only unreasonably dangerous to the user and consumer. And if it is, and a bystander happens to be hurt, as happens in many of these cases, then they can recover. A good example is the Indiana case we cited with the Scripto lighter.
Is Comanican wrong in what it said?
It's simply an old trial court decision.
Yeah. Is Geezy wrong?
What is Geezy?
That's 1983. I think Bielefus wrote it. If I remember correctly. And it says, let me see. Yeah, it's 1983, and Bielefus wrote it. Peter Geezy versus Montgomery Ward. It was their tractor, not yours. And in talking about Howes, it says, now it's describing what Howes said, and it says, in Howes 1, The jury answer to the strict liability question are completely independent of and irrelevant to its answer to the negligence question. The record contains evidence that the lawnmower was in a defective condition, unreasonably dangerous to users and bystanders. Now, I don't want to suggest that it says the issue in this case, or what are the words of the special verdict? No, that's not the case. But it talks about, referring to Howes here, and then taking the Howes decision and applying it here. It's unreasonably dangerous to users and bystanders, and that Montgomery Ward was, et cetera, et cetera. So you've got this thread of cases, starting with Howes 1, that talk about the concept in Howes 1, and then in Howes 2 it has unreasonably dangerous to bystanders, and Geesey it references that, and Comican it references that, and so I just think that's the law. And it's...
My red light is on, but I'll be happy to...
Chief, do you mind?
I'd like you to answer that.
Okay,
as
thank
with
you,
the
Chief
court.
Justice Abramson. A, I don't think it's the law. B, if it is, why hasn't the Jury Instructions Committee ever adopted it? And yet we pay deference to what this court has said, to the workings of it and its findings. Why hasn't this court ever said anything about it when, in fact, you have handled bystander cases? I read Vincer versus Esther Williams as a bystander case. This isn't a user case. That little tot who ended up brain dead because the ladder was left down in this above-ground swimming pool, he didn't dive in to go for a swim. He fell in, the court said. He was a bystander. And yet, again, this court looked at that product from the standpoint of the consumer, not the bystander tot. Likewise, I think the Keller case, the gas cap case we cited in our brief, is also a bystander case. Whether or not it's kids didn't have this gas can, didn't have a childproof lock on it, the kids got it off, boom, explosion, they're severely burned. What did this court say? It said the jury has to consider whether or not the ordinary consumer of this gas can should have been aware of the defects in it. That's presented a dangerous condition, not the kids. They arguably are bystanders as well. That's because even though it may seem harsh to you that we're kind of wordsmithing bystander, ordinary bystander, that's what strict liability is all about. It was to overcome privity obstacle, and it's to concentrate on the product as purchased by the user or consumer. And if it's dangerous to that person and an innocent bystander is inadvertently harmed, they can recover. But that's the test. And they still have another kick at the proverbial cat in negligence.
Counsel, you're opposing, you have indicated there are no factual disputes. Mr. Cavanaugh has suggested that there's never a good time, there's never a time in which the user should mow in reverse. Why is it that Deere manufactured the tractor to have the override system?
Well, technically, we could argue if it's override or not, because this is a total system, and one of the nice things about it, if you do shift into reverse, it dies. So that's a safety factor. Two things. One, maybe there was a slight dispute about the snowblower, but the record became clear that when this lawn tractor was sold, the blower attachment wasn't available for it, but it became available for it. But when the printed materials were printed, it wasn't on the market yet. When you plow with a snowblower into a snowbank, you have to back up. You have to keep that power takeoff shaft running to keep the snow going through the snowblower attachment. That's why they did it. The other reason is with the no-mow in reverse concept, you're wearing the heck out of the mechanical parts, the belts, the clutches, the chains, the bearings, because every single time you want to mow, or excuse me, back up, you've got to take it out of drive, and then you've got to shut down that power deck. And if you back up 2 feet to get around a flagpole, now you've got to engage the power takeoff shaft again, put it in forward, and go ahead. That is constant wear and tear on these mechanical parts. That's why we said use it to maneuver or reposition it. It's like your car. You park outside here if you're parallel parking. No, I don't think you're going to drive home tonight in reverse. You may use it to reposition the vehicle using reverse, but no one anticipates you're going to drive home in reverse. Like this lawnmower, so don't mow in reverse, but to save mechanically, and because we need it for the snowblower, you can use it simply to reposition. And you know the interesting thing, Justice Gableman? The operator acknowledged that. He said, yeah, I know. He admitted he was mowing, and it said you shouldn't mow. He said, I wasn't repositioning it. Yeah, I know what repositioning means. It's something far less than this. He said he mowed 18 feet without looking backward. Kid comes around a corner, boom.
Wasn't there some mention in the record about emergency situations which might require a quicker reverse than would be allowed without the reel?
Yes, there could be. And also it's important to know that the no-mow in reverse doesn't shut down the blaze, as the testimony was, instantaneous anyhow. That doesn't prevent an accident from happening. It takes a second or two or three for them to stop spinning. And when they are going 180 miles an hour, this could have happened with a no-mow in reverse because of failure to supervise that child, the blind corner and the father not paying attention. It doesn't stop it like this. That's an impossibility. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Zielinski.
Congratulate Mr. Zielinski on his retirement. I wish it had occurred a little bit earlier. Seriously, I've enjoyed working against Mr. Zielinski. I've known him for a number of years, and truly it's been a pleasure. And truly I do wish he had retired earlier, and truly I do want to receive a copy of his retirement reading list. Now, having said that, I'd like to cover just a couple of things. First of all, the whole issue of a bystander versus who's a user and consumer in terms of ENSER in those cases. If you have a school bus, and the issue is how do you design the mirrors? How do you design the mirrors to minimize the probability that a child, a bystander, is going to get run over? That's a bystander case. If the issue was a defective bolt on a riding lawnmower that would go shooting out the chute but poses no harm to the user, to the one who's operating it, but can seriously injure the next door neighbor, that's a bystander. In this case, the risk was not to the user, was not to the consumer. It was to bystanders. Would the legal test differ if it were the next door neighbor who was run over? Would the legal test differ if it was someone's prized pet who would run over? No. This case presents the issue of a manufacturer's responsibility to bystanders. And what Deere argues is, as long as we make it safe for the user-consumer, provide adequate warnings to the user-consumer about those people who are at risk, we have no further obligation. That doesn't make public policy sense. It doesn't make engineering sense. In this case, Deere's internal manual provided that its engineers were to minimize the risk to users and those in proximity of the product.
Two issues, the risk to the bystander being one, and the other one being whose contemplation you use?
Yes, precisely.
So even if we accept the bystander as within the frame of defective product, what about, are you still advocating that you have to have the bystander's contemplation?
Yes, otherwise the protection's meaningless. Because otherwise, what you do is allow manufacturers to do warnings to the user consumer to, in effect, delegate its responsibility to bystanders and to escape that responsibility in a strict liability setting. And the public policy is of strict liability to allow manufacturers to make reasonable cost choices as well. For example, you may remember back in the 70s and 80s, cars in America didn't have shoulder harnesses in the rear seats. They had shoulder harnesses in the rear seats all over the world, But the manufacturers knew that the usage rate for seatbelts was less than 10%. There were hardly any accidents where people were sitting in the rear seats. And the manufacturers made a reasonable decision. We're not going to put the belts back there because there are going to be so few injuries, and we save so much per car. And I don't say that decision's wrong from their standpoint economically. I don't stand up and say the corporation's bad. That's not my position. I just say when they sell that product unreasonably defective to that 12-year-old who's wearing lap belt and rear seat, that it's fair that they pay in strict liability when they cause injury to that person. And it's, go ahead.
Mr. Cabanis, I somewhat hesitate to ask this question, but both you and the Chief Justice posited a situation where an animal, a pet, could be damaged by the backing mechanism. I am just not understanding how there would be a bystander contemplation test if the injury was to an animal.
Is there really any difference? Again, you're applying the objective person. And if, you know, first of all, with respect to animals, the only damage is for the cost of the replacement value of the animals. We don't allow recovery for the emotional value. So when you run over the 10-year-old dog, for example, you know, the exposure is minimal because the value of the pet, the way we value it in pet cases, is minimal. But certainly the point I was trying to make is that a manufacturer should not be relieved of considering and designing for damage that can occur to other than the user operator.
It seems to me, and that was one of the points in my question, that if you use a consumer contemplation test, a consumer, a reasonable consumer, looks at that product and says, what is the danger to me? What's the danger to my family? What's the danger to anyone coming on my property, etc.? So I'm not quite sure that saying consumer contemplation test doesn't include the consumer thinking of the bystander or thinking of the pet. The pet, broadly speaking, was, from my question, a bystander. The problem is, or a problem may be, that if you use the terminology consumer contemplation in a jury instruction without further defining that the consumer can contemplate damage to himself, herself, and a broader group, that the jury will get that. And I think maybe that is what your difficulty is here.
The problem with that approach, Your Honor, is then the warnings which are adequate to that consumer that understands whatever the hazard is covered, but the next door neighbor is not, who does not have the benefit of those instructions and that specific information that the manufacturer has.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why it's important that protection be provided for bystanders.
And that is what the case is whole. The protection is for the bystander. I think that is relatively clear. Question is, what do you tell them about the contemplation standard?
Correct. And that's why, without having contemplation from the perspective of the bystander in this circumstance, it renders the protection meaningless. Because, the bystander doesn't have the benefit of the warnings and the instructions.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Thank you, sir. That concludes our argument in another product liability case. And we have had many product liability cases involving lawnmowers. And that terminates our hearing, 068P2933, Horst versus Deere & Company. The students who are remaining to discuss the procedure of the court. If the justice should stay here, then the justice will be out momentarily. We are in recess until 1:30.